Apex Express, Asian Pacific Expression.
Community and cultural coverage.
Music and calendar.
New visions and voices.
Coming to you with an Asian Pacific Islander point of view.
It's time to get on board the Apex Express.
Welcome to Apex Express, news and views with an API point of view. This week, we feature a people of color perspective on Occupy Oakland. We talk with Samina Sundas about the upcoming peace convention put on by American Muslim Voice. And we explore how the use of torture impacts the way democratic societies frame laws. Also, we have a ticket giveaway, so stay tuned. I'm your host, Jane Chang. Keep it locked here for Apex Express. This week, we've seen a massive crackdown on the Occupy Wall Street movement, with overnight raids in Los Angeles and Philadelphia. At the same time, folks are organizing for a West Coast port shutdown on December 12th. Where do people of color fit into this movement? Preeti Mangala Shekhar talks with Seema Rupani, a youth activist and labor organizer with Green for All, about how the Occupy movement actively involves and addresses low-income people of color and issues.
This is Preeti Mangala Shekhar for Apex Express. I have with me on air Seema Rupani, a youth activist and organizer who has been a part of Occupy Oakland since it began. Seema grew up in the Bay Area and has organized on her campuses and in her community since she was 16. Seema is now an organizer at Green for All, supporting economic opportunities for low-income communities and communities of color, while working to make communities more resilient to the effects of climate change. Welcome to Apex Express, Seema.
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's begin with all the Occupy Oakland stuff that you've been involved with. Tell us about how you've been involved with Occupy and what your role has been so far.
Yeah, I was involved. I was pretty heavily involved in Occupy in the beginning. Camped out there for a night and was out there, you know, almost every day going to the General Assemblies and the People of Color Caucus meetings in the beginning. Also helped to organize around the day that the encampment was shut down and raided by the police, and then there's a lot of police brutality out on the streets that evening, and so I was out there for all of that, got tear gassed like a bunch of other people did, went back to, you know, retake the camp with people, and then it was raided again.
Was that your first experience, first time being tear gassed?
Yeah, it was. It was horrible. It made me realize how much these chemical agents that they call mild or harmless are really designed to get people to panic, and I can imagine how many worse chemicals and instruments of oppression that they use in other countries, because here they say this one is harmless, but really, like, it was pretty harmful. I mean, I had contacts, I couldn't see anything, I couldn't breathe, my throat closed up, I was running down the street, and they threw the tear gas so far down the street that I couldn't get away from it, even though I was really far away. That's how far they threw it, is that I had to run all the way down the street and turn a corner to get onto another street to be free of tear gas.
Wow.
Yeah, they're super excessive and, like, unnecessary.
Yeah.
For the crowd that were that night.
And then, yeah, so continue. You were telling me about your role and also your role with the People of Color Caucuses.
Yeah, I've been a part of the People of Color Caucus. I haven't been going to meetings recently, but I was definitely, you know, going to them in the beginning and have still been engaged with the group. And now I'm doing more work through kind of like a coalition of groups that are working on economic justice and sustainability to try to figure out what we can contribute to Occupy and how we can continue to support the communities that we've been supporting, communities of color and low-income communities, the work that they've been doing, and build off this momentum of Occupy to support a lot of the grassroots work that's been happening in these communities for a really long time.
And then can you speak to some of the other issues that the POC caucuses have been bringing to the table, including immigrant rights and also other issues impacting specifically low-income communities of color?
Yeah. You know, the People of Color Caucus actually changed the name of their group to Decolonize Oakland, and that was a big theme in the beginning, was that a lot of people of color were not engaged with Occupy Movement or with Occupy Oakland in the beginning, because there have been occupations on our communities for a really long time, not just here in the U.S., but, you know, around the world, and, like, we're on occupied land right now. We're occupying land that belongs to Native Americans, to Indian people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely an understanding that Even the language of Occupy was really alienating for a lot of people, and so the People of Color Caucus changed their name to Decolonize Oakland and have been really working around that theme to bring that to the Occupy movement, to say that, imperialism is an occupation, and we, you know, what we're really trying to do is to decolonize.
As somebody who's been tracking Occupy Oakland, both as part of it and also witnessing how it's really evolved in the last few months, you know, the media was projecting it as largely white-led and representing white interests, you know, urban middle-class white folks frustrated and, you know, doing this.
Right.
But it's really not, and it's kind of evolved into actually a larger, much more vibrant movement. Could you speak to that in your opinion, in your, how you've witnessed the movement shift?
Yeah, you know, I think with a lot of the social movements that happen here, and the social movements I've been a part of the U.S., in the U.S., it's a lot of times movements are portrayed as that, as like the leadership is mostly white and middle class, or like white anarchists, angry kids. And I think there's definitely that demographic there. But the, like, what's interesting about this movement is that it's actually been getting more and more diverse over time. I've noticed it's been getting more diverse, more people from different backgrounds and different colors and classes have been coming into the movement and taking leadership positions and like inserting, you know, their knowledge and their experience in a lot of ways. And so, like, for example, the People of Color Caucus, a lot of people from that caucus are not just part of that caucus. They're also part of the planning committee or the facilitation committee or, you know, the general assembly. And so I think it's easy for the media to portray it as that, and because that's also an easy way to kind of dismiss this movement as being just protest politics, maybe like angry, you know, white anarchist kids or whatever it is that they're portraying it as. But I think it's definitely changed over time. It's not that. And also during the port shutdown, the day that there was a general strike in Oakland and the port shutdown, the media paid so much attention to what happened later that day with the Black Bloc, which were, you know, mostly white anarchists. Kids who did do a lot of damage, and that wasn't endorsed or supported by a lot of others that occupy Oakland, and I think, you know, the media has a tendency to pay attention to that because it's, you know, what, how they want to portray the movement. But I think you get a totally different picture by just going to a meeting or a general assembly.
So moving on to talking about how the space of Occupy Oakland has been able to accommodate a wide range of issues, interests, and groups working on various various issues, and that has been an energizing for me to see. So for you, as somebody who works with Green for All, tell us about the campaigns and issues. Tell us about the issues that you're bringing into the space.
Yeah, you know, I'll say, like, during the strike, the general strike, we had a contingent of different Green and justice groups that were under the banner of People and Planet Before Profit, right? And so it's an understanding that the same corporations that wield way too much power in politics, and the same corporations that are responsible for our economic crisis in a lot of ways are also the same ones that are causing catastrophic ecological disasters and climate change and environmental injustices that cause children asthma and, you know, cause a lack of access to healthy food in our communities. And so having an understanding that ecological solutions that build local resilience and local community power are also solutions to the economic crisis is something that I think a lot of green, not just green, but a lot of, I'd say, environmental justice or groups that are focused on climate change and poverty, on addressing those two issues simultaneously, are bringing to the table at the Occupy movement. And for example, there are a lot of groups that are going to be coming together this Friday at Occupy Oakland with a resolution to ask for solidarity with the December 3rd Global Day of Action, which is happening at the same time that the UN climate negotiations are happening. And so we're bringing this resolution to them to say, look, a lot of politicians are going to be meeting in Durban, South Africa, as they meet in different places around the world every year, to talk about so-called solutions to climate change, but a lot of them are really false solutions. And they're solutions that, you know, commodify air, land, and water and resources that should be shared by everyone and resources that are not for sale. And that instead we want to lift up solutions that are coming from our communities that are building local resilience. And so we're going to be bringing this resolution, and hopefully Occupy Oakland passes it. I think, you know, I have a feeling that they will, because it's kind of seems like that's the direction that the Occupy movement has been going in. Like, in the beginning, it was a lot of, I think it was an outlet for a lot of anger and outrage that people were feeling. And I think it definitely has been moving beyond just protesting injustice towards self-determination and what it means to build resilient communities. Like, why are we protesting in the first place? What do we actually want our communities to look like? And what are some solutions that are already happening? How can we lift those up and model those instead of waiting for our government to, you know, or corporations to pull us out of this?
I want to talk about all the actions coming up, including the West Coast shutdown on the 12th. But before that, I was wondering if you could also speak to, you know, one of the things over the Thanksgiving holiday break that's been interesting to me is how, I spent the time in the South Bay with a lot of my, you know, friends who work in Silicon Valley and, you know, have whole middle to upper middle class jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the usual complaint and refrain of what does this occupy people? What do the people want? Right? Because that's mm-hmm. how they used to campaigns that have like minimum demands and mm-hmm. have like specific demands and visible leadership and so on, which all this is not about. So how do you respond to it, and what has been your experiences? I know when we talked about it earlier that you said you've also been facing some of that kind of, you know,
right.
tiring refrains from people. So what is your response and thoughts as a young activist leader yourself?
Yeah. That's a good question. I've been getting a lot of that, not just from my family members and people who might not necessarily agree with or like understand Occupy, but also from older people, from people who have been active for a long time and who may be a little bit cynical or, you know, whatever it is. And I understand there are reasons for that for sure. But I've been getting a lot of rhetoric around like, why, what is Occupy? What are their goals? What are their demands? They're not going to be successful unless they have specific demands. But I really think that having specific demands can be really limiting. You know, I told you before that we're so used to fighting for scraps as activists and organizers or people who are just trying to change our community. We're so used to fighting for scraps from our government that it feels kind of hard to like be in a place where we don't have demands because we're not sure if we're going to get anything out of this. But I think Occupy is about something much larger than that. You know, it's not about getting the city to give us a building for like our meetings or something like that. It's not getting permission from the city to allow us to be on a certain part of the downtown plaza or whatever it is. It's about really changing, like fundamentally creating change in America based on new values. And I think that takes time. That's slow politics. You know, it's going to take a really long time.
Yeah, creating a shift sort of, right, in the narrative and in the discourse that we've been having in this country.
Right.
That is pro-capitalist. I see it as really attempting a shift in the failure of the current economic system.
Yeah, and I see it as like, you know, it's not just, I think a lot of people at Occupy have had the courage to challenge ourselves and to acknowledge that, you know, we as Americans have enjoyed comforts at the expense of other people all around the world for a really long time. And so this movement is not about fighting for demands that'll increase our living standards so that we get certain benefits. It's about changing the structure of society and living the kinds of lives that are going to slow down global warming, that are ecologically sustainable, and that will end the huge inequality, not just here in the U.S., but also in the world between countries of the global north and countries of the south. And so, you know, I think that that's something that's hard for a lot of people to understand because they don't believe in fundamental change or that can happen. And I really think that that's what the social movement is about. It's about this larger change and like reorganizing society, really.
Before we wrap up, if you could speak to some of the actions and campaigns that are coming up. You mentioned the one happening this Saturday on December 3rd. And of course, if you could speak to the larger one that's happening on 12-12, on December 12th. Could you speak to that?
Yeah. So on December 3rd, the Saturday, is going to be a global day of action that Grassroots Global Justice Alliance and La Via Campesina have been calling in solidarity with frontline communities around the world who have been fighting for climate justice. And there's going to be an action here in East Oakland at Tassafarango Farm, which is a place that residents have been organizing around, and Communities for a Better Environment is leading that effort. So I'm not going to say too much about it, but they're leading that effort along with residents. And it's going to be kind of a teach-in, and they're going to be planting more raised beds. And there's also going to be other actions happening that day, I think, on Saturday around the Keystone Pipeline. And then December 12th is going to be a West Coast port shutdown. And so Occupy Portland, Occupy San Diego, Occupy LA, Occupy Tacoma have all signed on to this West Coast port shutdown. And that's happening on December 12th. And I'm really interested to see what happens there. I mean, there were thousands of people at the last port shutdown. And so, you know, I think that when we do actions like that, like port shutdowns, it has more of like a transnational framework in it, understanding that this is a global struggle.
Right.
And I think that's the value in doing something like that. Find a way to be engaged and don't think that the movement's over just because the encampments are shut down, because it's really not about the, it's not really just about the encampments at all.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Seema, for your analysis, and all the best as you continue to work and be a part of this amazing movement.
Thank you.
That was Preeti Mangalashekar talking with Seema Rupani, a youth activist and organizer with Green for All. For more information and updates about upcoming actions and rallies in solidarity with the Occupy movement, visit OccupyOakland.org and WestCoastPortShutdown.org. And now for a ticket break. The great Jake Shimabukuro, a.k.a. the Jimi Hendrix of the ukulele, will be performing at the Warfield tomorrow, Friday, December 3rd at 9 p.m. You don't want to miss it. We have three pairs of tickets to offer our first three callers. The number is 510-848-4425. That's 510-848-4425. So while you're calling, we'll listen to Jake performing Michael Jackson's Thriller on the ukulele. Up next, Apex contributor Nono Girl talks with Samina Sundas, founding director of American Muslim Voice, about their upcoming peace convention, Awakening the American Spirit, turning the tide of hate into love.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Apex Express, Samina. Can you start by just telling us what American Muslim Voice is, how it got started, and what some of your programs are?
Sure. American Muslim Voice was founded in the aftermath of 9/11. Before 9/11 happened, I was already involved in a Muslim political organization. I stayed with that organization for about 2 to 3 years. And thought that this would roll over and we will go back to empowering Muslims to become involved in the political arena, to just become full citizens. But in July 2003, I realized that it's not going to happen. Hate against Muslims was on the rise rather than subsiding. It was just crimes against Muslims were on the rise. So I decided that it's time to go in the mainstream and really provide my fellow Americans first-hand contact with the Muslims, and so they could learn about Islam and Muslims from us rather than from the media and the Bush administration.
And so what are some of the programs that you do to meet that mission?
So our mission is just basically fostering friendships among all Americans by bridging the cultural and religious gap. And the programs are very simple but very heartwarming. What we do is we open our homes, our hearts, and our minds, and we ask our fellow Americans to do the same. We do the open houses, we host peace picnics, we do iftar dinners, and we do Eid brunches, any cultural event that we can share with our fellow Americans. We do that by opening our homes. And that becomes very intimate, even though sometimes I have about 150 to 200 people during the 4-hour span, but still something about a home and welcoming somebody in your home just sends a very clear message that I trust you, and by them coming to the homes, they are just sending you the message, I accept your friendship and I trust you.
And I'm sure that that kind of community buildings, especially in the aftermath of 9/11, was really grounding and reassuring. Can you talk about who makes up your membership? I mean, the face of Islam is very diverse. So who are some of the members of American Muslim Voice?
So let me just explain about our name. A lot of the time, people automatically assume that we are a religious organization just because there is Muslim in our name. We are not a religious organization. We are a community and peace-building organization. The reason we wanted to keep Muslim in our name, because since 9/11, everything that is happening in America and around the world, people just automatically assume that Islam is to blame and Muslims are to blame. So all the negativity was getting attached to Muslims and Islam. That's the reason we kept Muslim in there, because we knew the kind of work we are going to be doing will be all positive, nothing negative about it. So we wanted to make sure that Muslims and Islam get some benefit from our work. And our members are, one of our board members is Grace. She's Japanese American, and we have young people, we have older people, we have from India, we have from Burma, we have from Pakistan, and some of the people who are born here, American Muslims. So it is just really the most diverse organization you will find, with women, men, young people, young adults, and it's just very much balanced.
Well, when you talk about that positive approach, you have an upcoming peace convention, and this is a somewhat annual event. So can you talk about what the peace convention is and what the theme is?
Sure. So every year we come up with a special theme, and we actually spend a lot of time with coming up for our themes, because I think that reflects who we are, what we are all about, and what we want to, you know, convey to the rest of the world. Like last year, our theme, and that's basically our slogan, what you want to call our umbrella message or the most mantra, however you want to describe, from fear to friendship. So every positive event we do, whether it's a candlelight vigil to honor the victims of 9/11 or to, you know, hold for somebody's prayer against the war. Whatever we do, our main goal, one theme is always on our mind and in our hearts, is from fear to friendship. The world is really afraid of each other. 9/11 just put the icing on the cake, and our political people who wanted to take advantage and further their agenda had created a culture of hate, anger, division, and violence. And our goal is to replace it with a culture of hope, inclusion, love, and peace. So we do a lot of things, yes.
And this year?
This year, our theme is awakening the American spirit, turning the tide of hate into love.
And what are some of the ways that you're gonna that the convention is going to embody that theme?
We are very afraid. Muslims in general are very afraid of the election year coming up. Reason being, every time there is an election, some of the people just want to take advantage of that and create further fear and further division in our country. And already there is so much negativity coming around our way. There are books published for kids, believe it or not, about what is Islam all about and all the negativity in that. And then our politicians like Herman Cain made nasty remarks about Muslims that he would never hire. If he's a winner, he would never hire a Muslim for his administration. Then he apologized. Then he started doing that again. And then there's King, Congressman King, who had these radical hearings against Muslims and Islam. There are people continuing to do that. So we are just trying to create a safe space for our fellow Americans. They could come, whatever is on their mind, whether it's about Sharia, whether it is about Muslim women's rights, jihad, Islam being a cult, not a religion, all these things. They can just, you know, come and learn from us. And we're just saying that we are the Muslims. We are the people who practice Islam every day. We live Islam. So you can come and, you know, learn it from us. This is going to be a 90-minute session.
Right. You were saying that one of the tracks that you could go on is a conversation with Muslim scholars.
Right.
Where people can ask questions about Sharia law and any kind of question that they might have.
Whatever is on their mind. Yeah.
And it's a safe space to kind of demystify the religion.
Yeah. Demystify the meaning of jihad, women's rights, Sharia. You know, Sharia is what, I'll give you one example. Rais Buyan, who is our featured speaker, he's coming from Dallas, and he's a gentleman who was shot by a hateful white guy who just killed two other innocent people and left Rais for dead. Rais, in return, forgave him, and he tried to spare his life, went to the governor of Texas, appealed, and then appealed to Supreme Court. He lost that, but he tried. So, you know, there's death penalty in Texas, so this man was killed just recently. But Rais has been a shining star and the best ambassador of Islam because he made a statement. He said, "My religion teaches me that saving one human being is saving humanity. Killing one human being is as killing humanity." So he will be there, and I don't want anybody to miss his story, courageous story of love, peace, forgiveness, and courage. This man still carries 35 those BB bullets in his face. He's partially blind, but he had this in him to forgive. And I think if all of us practice our religion, all religions ask for forgiveness, compassion, love. If all of us would do that, this world would be such a beautiful place to live in.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a really great convention where people can learn and also find some inspiration just amongst these activists who are doing things, whether it's around civil rights, whether it's around identity, whether it's around religious freedom, or even here around like redemptive justice. So how can people find out more information?
Well, they could go on our website, which is, or they can Google us, American Muslim Voice, and we have detailed information, bios for our panelists, scholars, featured speakers. Then we have how they can sponsor. Even if somebody could not come, they could sponsor a student. What we're trying to do is teach our students on early ages so they don't learn hate and then unlearn it in the later years. So we are trying to ask the schools if they could just bring their students. You know, we want schools to get involved, community colleges, universities, whoever wants to be part. And civil rights panel is very important. You could learn the lives of Muslims during the past decade, marked by detentions, deportations, suspicions, sting operations, erosion of civil liberties, Patriot Act, INS special registration, attacks on Muslim charities, anti-Islam FBI trainings, then GPS tracking for Muslim men, Irvine 11 case. There are so many things. And the latest for my Latino brothers and sisters, Secure Communities Program, which is not secure at all. That just makes the communities very insecure. And people of color are very afraid to do anything to speak up against, you know, what is happening.
Well, thank you so much for putting on this convention. It's going to be a rich resource. And thank you for joining us on Apex Express.
Thank you for having me. And please spread the word and let your audience know that, you know, we welcome anybody and nobody would be turned away. If somebody cannot afford it, we will find a way to have them there as our guests.
That was No-No Girl talking with Samina Sundas with American Muslim Voice. The Peace Convention is on Sunday, December 11th from 4 to 9 p.m. in Newark, California. For more information, visit amuslimvoice.org. You're listening to Apex Express on KPFA 94.1 FM. Now we bring you a discussion on torture and its impact on law in democratic societies. Professor Jin E. Locanita teaches political science at Drew University in New Jersey. She is the author of Transnational Torture, Law, Violence, and State Power in the United States and India, which looks at the use of torture in liberal democracies and how this forces us to confront the limits of progressive law in our societies. Apex Express contributor Hanjoy Barbara spoke with her at UC Berkeley, where she delivered a lecture at the Center for the Study of Law and Society.
One of the issues that you highlight in your book deals with torture not being theorized in liberal democracies. How has this happened?
I'll give you two examples, both in the context of India and the United States. So, for instance, if you think about how the incidents at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have been understood, they were primarily seen as being the result of aberrant, you know, state officials, right? So basically the few bad apples, like Lindy England, the iconic image of Lindy England holding a leash around an Iraqi detainee's neck, that became the image. And again, it was almost as if these particular individuals were responsible for the abuse and torture that happened, rather than thinking about whether as a policy, right, torture or excessive violence is authorized. So I think when you just think of it as a problem of enforcement by a few bad apples, you do not think about the role that violence plays in liberal states per se. Now, in the context of India, you find that, you know, there's obviously decades of human rights reports that point to custodial deaths and torture. But often the focus is on problems at the level of policing, right, or at the level of army, right? So the particular state agency which is involved in the violence. Now, undoubtedly, one has to look at the problems there. But at the same time, I think we have to look at whether, you know, at the level of the jurisprudence, there is some enabling of that violence. And that's what my book tries to do, to force us to think about, you know, problems not just at the level of the actors of violence or at the level of enforcement, but rather violence as a problem, as a, an issue for liberal democracies, democratic states, and the law.
You touch upon the judiciary as well, and liberal democracies, by definition, are supposed to have autonomous and independent judiciaries. What is their role in condoning torture and state violence? Can you give us some examples from the U.S. and maybe even from India?
That's an excellent question. I think we do have to look at the role of the judiciary in particular, particularly the Supreme Court. Both, the countries that I look at have very important roles that are given constitutionally to the Supreme Court. And yet we find that, there are problems in the way they engage with the question of torture. And this is how, I understand it. I think if you think about the U.S. Supreme Court, as far as I think physical torture, particularly in the context of interrogations, is concerned, I think there is a very clear signal given that that's not acceptable, right? But I think anything less than that, particularly less physically brutal forms of violence or mental violence, there is lack of clarity regarding that. And the implication of that is that whenever there's particularly a situation of necessity, right, often in the context of, terrorism suspects, that lack of clarity goes a long way in enabling methods of interrogation which should not be allowed within, liberal democracies, right? So that's something that one needs to look at more closely. The second thing, in terms of the post 9/11 context in particular, you find that the U.S. Supreme Court actually has not taken up any case of torture, right? So people, brought cases of torture regarding rendition. They wanted to, sue the government. They wanted to basically, the amicus briefs that were filed in many detention cases and the case that actually came to the Supreme Court basically said that you need to give a very clear signal on torture. Now, they did talk about detention. They did talk about, what are some of the due process rights which are available in some of the key Supreme Court cases like Hamdan and Bomedin in particular. And those are very important interventions. But at the same time, they stop short of addressing one of the most important challenges of the torture debate, which is what exactly is meant by torture, what is allowed and not allowed in questions of necessity, and so on and so forth. Right? Very quickly on India, you actually find that one of the reasons why the police has been so much the focus of being held responsible for torture is because the Indian Supreme Court has given a number of very progressive judgments on torture, right? Trying to think about custodial violence in particular, right? And if that were to be exactly right, the whole question of the arrest memo and custody memo and so on and so forth, I think those are partly the result of PILs being filed, but the civil liberty groups and democratic rights groups basically taking it up very systematically, right? So I think there's a sense in which, there have been very progressive judgments. But at the same time, even in that, you find that very quickly the court starts getting concerned about false cases, right? False cases of torture. Even though, the irony of the custody jurisprudence of the Indian Supreme Court is that they're primarily talking about custodial deaths. They don't look at custodial torture as, carefully, right? And I think part of the challenge has been to connect both of these, right? But if you think about the more extraordinary laws, right? For instance, TADA, POTA, Armed Forces Special Powers Act, the Indian Supreme Court has not had a very progressive history. It has, in fact, upheld all these extraordinary laws, right, and given it much more of a constitutional legitimacy, right, thereby, in a sense, undermining its custody jurisprudence in the routine context, right? So I think there the Indian Supreme Court, in one arena, right, in the D.K. Basu kind of cases, has given a more progressive, protection to dealing with custodial violence, but has undermined that when it comes to particular kinds of laws such as, terrorist and disruptive activities prevention act and prevention of terrorism act and armed force special powers act. So I think you have to look at both together when you're assessing the role of the judiciary as far as these laws are concerned.
Your book's title is Transnational Torture, so it's something that is really counterintuitive in the sense that we don't think that torture can be translated across nations. At least 20 years ago, you wouldn't say that. The United Nations Declaration of Human Rights was a really state-sponsored thing, and we thought that certain states torture its citizens. But with this idea of transnational terror, we are onto a new political terrain here. We are into the terrain of contractors, into the terrain of drones. It's really something that the world hasn't seen before. So how is law going to keep pace with this? Do you see kind of more authoritarian forms of national law emerging in liberal democracies, for example, to keep pace with this form of, let's say, methods of governing people?
I think, you know, you're right to kind of point to this title, particularly because when you think about transnationalism, it's really about going across, right, practices and, you know, people and regimes kind of, interacting with each other. So I think you can think about transnational in two ways. One, as you were saying, that perhaps this is an indication that states are becoming more and more authoritarian. And I think, you know, you think about it, you can actually identify practices which can suggest that, right? And, I mean, if you think about what's going on in Chhattisgarh, you know, what's going on in Kashmir and Northeast and Andhra, I mean, there is a sense in which the levels of, state violence, right, in its most visible form has only increased, right? But at the same time, I think what we have to also recognize is, and particularly in the context of torture, which is, you know, what I'm focusing on, is the fact that as torture basically continues to remain across centuries or through the centuries, one of the things it starts doing is to force states to come up with more innovative forms of violence, right? So in other words, if you think about the techniques that are being used now, right, often are coming in the form of more scientific techniques, right, where you want to involve professional, medical professionals, psychologists, right, and, Darius Rajali, who's written this book on torture, actually talks about how democracies are actually forced to do this because ironically, the impact of human rights critiques, right? They have to come up with what he calls non-scarring techniques, right? Just so that they can avoid detection and monitoring. And in that sense, in the context of U.S., that's what you see in terms of some of the more controversial techniques that came up. In India, what the irony is that it's not as if physical forms of torture disappear, right? They kind of coexist compatibly, right, with the more non-scarring techniques, right? So, for instance, think about, this desire of the Indian state to kind of come up with methods like narcoanalysis or brain scanning and so on and so forth. Again, forms of violence, but are of a very different kind, right? So that necessity to bring in these, non-scarring techniques is something that we have to understand as well, right? So some practices pointing to more authoritarian tendencies, other practices actually talking about the innovations, right? The innovative techniques that are, that can coexist and exist in a liberal democracy.
You began talking about narco tests and truth serums and stuff like that. So can I just ask you briefly to stay on that subject for a bit and tell us a little bit more about how this is becoming so important, not only in your own research, but in techniques of, let's say, interrogation in liberal democracies?
So I think that's a really important question that we have to look at, particularly because the last decade or so, the Indian criminal justice system has tried to use, you know, what can be called truth-telling techniques, right? They claim that that's how truth is kind of derived from people by using narcoanalysis, which is basically use of sodium pentothal, and basically or using brain scanning where MRIs are taking up the brain to see whether, you know, a particular wave spikes up when a lie is told, right? So the reason why I think it's important to focus on that is because in a sense they point to a desire to contrast them with physical third degree, right? So I was very struck by, you know, how a lot of high courts which, you know, defended these techniques saying that, okay, they're basically a normal part of the investigation. They should be allowed, right? Oftentimes they would say, because they are so much better than physical third degree, and human rights groups have always critiqued that, so let us use this. Not recognizing that these forms actually take away the volition, right, of a person entirely, and actually impact the person, you know, physically and medically, right? There's enough evidence to show that, and basically have not been seen as scientifically or legally reliable, right? Now, the Supreme Court has actually come out and said that these techniques cannot be used without consent. But, you know, you have to think about, you know, what consent means in custody, right? It's almost like they don't recognize the implication of their own jurisprudence, which talked about power relations in custodial situations, right? So what does it mean to say that they can consent to it, especially if they are told that, you know, this is how you can escape it, this is how, you know, the truth can come out, you know, informally told that, right? So there's a sense in which I think consent is only one aspect of it. It does not address part of what I've been saying, which is that, you know, these are much more insidious forms of, you know, state techniques of governing, right, that need to be looked at very closely in order to see how they come in, precisely because they can be easily contrasted to being better than physical third degree, right, but don't address the violence that lie behind these techniques.
A last question then, Ginny. This brings us to really the role of human rights and civil liberties and democratic rights groups. Where do you see the democratic rights movement heading in liberal democracies such as India and the US? Because not everything that they say, I mean, some of the stuff that they say is being appropriated by the state and is being thrown back at them in ways in which they don't even recognize it anymore. For example, compensation. And like you're saying, non-scarring techniques that don't torture people. So they're saying, oh, we won't torture, but we'll do it in other ways. So where's the human rights, civil liberties and democratic rights movement headed from here?
Well, you know, one of the things that I should say, of course, is that the only way I could, you know, say what I say in my book, right, is precisely because of the amazing work that has been done by human rights groups and civil liberty activists in India and US. And I think one of the things that I would actually say is perhaps, you know, to some extent you're right that it's a co-option of the language, right? But I think to some extent I would almost think of it as the Supreme Court being forced to recognize some of what, you know, the civil liberty groups and democratic rights groups have been saying in India, for instance, right? Because even though they don't acknowledge it, right? But I think, you know, to give you a very quick example, the whole idea of, you know, the custody memo is precisely to basically recognize that a lot of the times that people would be just picked up without anybody knowing, right? And then they would appear either, you know, they've disappeared or they are dead, right? But when you have the custody memo, right, which is meant to kind of ensure that somebody from the public signs it, right, then there's a sense in which it's finally recognizing some of the, you know, some of what the human rights groups have been saying. That said, I mean, given the problems in implementation, right, I think, you know, you're right to that extent to say that, you know, whether these then remain symbolic activities. And I think, you know, that arena has to constantly be negotiated, right? I think what I would say is to perhaps find ways of both connecting what's going on in the conflict areas to what's going on in terms of routine interrogation rooms and so on and so forth, and break that or at least create a continuum between the conversations on the criminal justice system and the conflict areas, right? And perhaps, you know, much more of, you know, the international and the national groups kind of working together. But I think, you know, to some extent, decades of documentation has precisely brought us to this understanding about that the continuing role of violence within law and liberal states.
Thank you very much, Jenny.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being here.
That was Hanjoy Barbara interviewing Professor Jin E. Lokanita about her research on the use of torture in liberal democracies and its consequent impact on the limits of progressive law. And now the community calendar. Friday is the Asians Moving Power event that we featured a couple of weeks ago. This is a performing arts event at the Aya Hotel Manila Town Center organized by the students in Valerie So's Asian American Studies Workshop at San Francisco State. On Friday, December 2nd, the National Radio Project, producer of the show Making Contact, that also airs on KPFA on Friday afternoons, will host a fundraiser reception in honor of David Barsamian, noted radio journalist and producer of the popular show Alternative Radio. David was recently deported from India for his coverage of the human rights situation in Kashmir. Tickets are a sliding scale of $30 to $50. This event takes place at the Commons Room of the Temescal Creek Co-Housing at 322 45th Street off Broadway in North Oakland. Email Lisa Redman at rudman@radioproject.org for discounted tickets and more information. On Sunday, December 4th, from 2 to 4 p.m., Louis Suzuki will hold a talk in Berkeley. Last month, Louis Suzuki went to Washington, D.C. and received the Congressional Gold Medal for his service in the Military Intelligence Service during World War II, along with soldiers of the 442nd Regiment and the 100th Battalion. During World War II, Louis fought against Japanese imperialism. After the war ended, he continued to fight against imperialism as an anti-war activist protesting U.S. militarism. Louis Suzuki's talk will be held at 2240 Grant Street in Berkeley. NJHAS is holding a Peace Crane Ornament Workshop on Saturday at their Japantown headquarters. Participants can create a pair of ornaments, one to take home and the other to sell at the NJAHS Peace Gallery. And we're excited for Kat Avasco's one-woman show at Bindlestiff's called Mommy Queerist. If Margaret Cho and Ellen DeGeneres conceived a lesbian love baby, she would have nothing on the hilarious Bay Area actor and stand-up comic. Performances are Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m., now through December 17th. On Tuesday, December 6th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the David Brower Center in downtown Berkeley, the Women's Earth Alliance will host an event discussion on their India program working with women farmers addressing climate change in their communities. Tickets are $15 in advance and $18 at the door. For tickets and more information, visit womensearthalliance.org. For more information on these events, visit our website at apexexpress.org. If you have any questions or topics for future shows, shoot us an email at apex@kpfa.org. Thank you to our callers. I've been your host, Jane Chang, with Sam, the Shaolin B-Boy at the boards. Thank you for listening to Apex Express. Up next, the Bonnie Simmons Show.